This is Frank Preston, recorded at the Hope Bay Reunion in Coniston by Chris Alden Lee on the 20th of October 2009.
My name is Frank Preston. I was born in Leicester on the 1st of June 1938.
What kind of schooling did you have, Frank?
The sort of normal state schools, because in my day there was 11 plus, so I went to Hinckley Grammar School. And then from there I went on to the University of Bristol.
What was your first brush with the Antarctic? When were you first aware of it, would you say?
I suppose the film Scott of the Antarctic, I would think.
John Mills?
Yes.
What, was it captivating?
I think so, yes. And of course the music is particularly atmospheric, yes.
So in what way were you impressed, would you say, with that, with the Antarctic as you saw it through the... Because that was a real Antarctic. They filmed, didn't they?
Yes.
The background shots were filmed there.
That's right.
Did you come out wanting to go?
No, I don't think so particularly. It was just an exciting adventure. And, of course, a terribly sad ending, which, you know, I can't remember how old I was then, but my early teens, I suppose. And, yes.
And so what in the end was it that drew you to go there?
The work, my ambition... I took a degree in geography at Bristol, which included quite a content of land survey. So my ambition was to be a land surveyor. And I probably shouldn't say this, but I have to say FIDS was actually my second choice. I really wanted to join something called the Directorate of Overseas Surveys, which was a British government organisation doing mapping work overseas. And I didn't get past the interview. And a whole group of us, I think about four of us from Bristol, had gone up for the overseas surveys interviews and then for the FIDS interview.
So none of you got the job?
One person got into DOS and I was the lucky one that got into FIDS.
Oh, really? So
only two of us out of the four got in initially.
Was that always your plan? Was FIDS always your plan B?
Yes, that was plan B, yeah. Yeah. And this was really through the teaching staff at the university.
They recommended it, didn't
they? Yeah, so one of the lecturers was a big wheel in the British Schools Exploring Society. So Murray
Lepp,
a man called Frank Hannell, and because Murray Levick had been one of the founders of the British Schools Exploring Society, so you know there were sort of Antarctic connections there. So hence we were encouraged to apply for FIDS. Yes.
When you applied to DOS, though, you weren't necessarily applying to go to the Antarctic, wasn't you?
No, that was a permanent career in the civil service, whereas of course FIDS was a 2.5-3 year contract, so that was the attraction of DOS, that it was a long term prospect, and in fact when I came back from FIDS I was fortunate enough to be offered a place in DOS, possibly partly as a result of my FIDS experience.
So your ambition was fulfilled.
Yes, it was very much.
Did the Antarctic become more than just a means to an end when you got there? Was it a lot more?
Oh, I think so, yes, because I think you have to remember in those days, nobody did gap years. So, I mean, I was 21 when I graduated. I think we're all in... The graduate sort of output was all, in some ways, relatively inexperienced and a bit green. And then to be thrust into something like FIDS was a huge learning experience. I mean...
How do you mean?
Well, one did all sorts of jobs. I mean, I'd never cut meat up before and this sort of thing, and we had to butcher seals to feed the dogs and so on and so forth. And so you had to do jobs because there was nobody else to do them. You know, you couldn't duck out of them. If somebody said, oh, get this done, you did it.
You know. Do you find cutting up seals unpleasant work?
Initially, yes. I mean, my mother had always done all that. All the cooking in our house, you know.
Not many seals in Leicestershire.
No, but I mean, sort of cutting up meat and this sort of thing, I wasn't. Yeah. I was a bit squeamish, perhaps, I don't know. But anyway, obviously one became accustomed to it. So
what saw you through that initial revulsion?
Well, just compulsion and necessity. It had to be done, you know. And, you couldn't turn to somebody else and say, well, you do it, you know. So you had to do it.
Let's just go back to the two interviews then. I appreciate it's a long time ago, but was there a significant difference in the interview process?
To be honest, I can't really remember. I wouldn't like to say no. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the interviewers were looking for. Whether they were looking for different things, they obviously, the DOS people obviously took the chap they thought would fit the bill well. And in fact, he did go on to to quite high things, to being a director in the Ordnance Survey, whereas I always stayed at a sort of modest level of a party leader in the field, which I was happy with.
Would you say that the FID's selection process was rigorous or a bit more relaxed than that?
My memory of it was relaxed, but I have to say, I think one of the things that always impressed me was that people were picked as individuals, but then we were lumped together in a way, it appeared, where we were. I mean, I was part of a six-man base, you know, and, OK, we need two surveyors and a geologist and a radio operator and a couple of general assistants, you know. And we weren't picked as a team, we were picked as individuals, and yet we melded together very well, I think. I mean, there were stories of problems on some of the bases, but I never experienced any. It was...
Looking back now with hindsight and a bit more life experience behind you, can you work out how they did that?
Not really, no. No, I'm sorry to be negative, but
no,
I can't really, no. They obviously went into people's backgrounds and presumably looked to people they saw who were sort of amenable and flexible in their attitude and outlook to life, you know.
So they were looking for relaxed chaps rather than...
Rather than go-getters, I would say so, yes. But whether that was a good thing for the survey, I'm not sure. But, I mean, certainly as a group we all got on well, you know.
Was there a chap called Bill Sloman involved in this process?
I can't remember. I mean, I know Bill Sloman, but I can't remember. I can't remember if he was at the interview or not.
Yeah.
I mean, this was 1959 when
I was... It is exactly 50 years ago.
Yes.
So, when... All right, so you were selected...
Yes.
Was there then a very nice, relaxed period before you went south, or were you often on your travels pretty quickly?
No, the land surveyors were given a training course of about 3 months, which, funnily enough, was at the Overseas Surveys headquarters, which was in Tolworth in Surrey. and that was run by a man called Norman Leppard, who you may have heard of. I don't know. Norman, unfortunately, was killed in a road accident about 5-6 years ago. But he'd been down south already previously at Hope Bay. So he ran a training course for, there were three of us. Three of us and Duncan Cass joined us, which is a name you must know, and because he was about to go to South Georgia on his last expedition. And we did surveying up on Epsom Downs, which was very pleasant. It was a very warm summer that summer.
So you met him, did you?
Oh, yes, yes.
What did you make of him?
Quite a withdrawn individual, but... didn't really get a very strong impression, no, because we only saw him when we were out doing these exercises on the Downs. He was living in someone's garden shed in Hampstead at that stage, and he cycled over to Epsom every day on a bicycle. So he's quite a character, but I couldn't really give any more.
What about Norman? What sort of character was Norman Leppard?
I think Norman was quite a father figure to us. He was the man with all the experience that we looked up to, and he was a very good surveyor. He'd been trained by the Ordnance Survey, so he's say no more. So Norman was very good to us and really did look after us. And then we had, I think it was 2 weeks, at Virginia Water, which was the Imperial College field station there, and a man called Alfred Stevenson taught us field astronomy for fixing positions and what have you. And he'd been on the British Graham Land expedition in the 1930s. So again, he was very much a sort of almost godlike figure, you know. And,
so a lot of this was new stuff, was it, this training course? It wasn't old ground recovered, it was new material.
Some of it was new, and of course it was very much directed towards the conditions in the Antarctic. I mean, we'd done a fair amount of work on the undergraduate course, but yeah, it was a refresher course in some ways. The field astronomy was new. We'd done sunshots before, but not starshots.
And how, if at all, could they actually prepare you for the Antarctic? Were you given any training on how to survive the conditions down there?
No. No, I mean, we did the survey course and then we were virtually sort of more or less straight onto the ship, you know. But of course, FIDS at that time had this situation where we were all down for 2 winters, so there was always a mixture of people who'd already done a winter with the new people who'd come in. So, I mean, both my years, I was part of a six-man team and we had at least two people in out of the six who'd already spent a winter down there. So they passed on their experience and taught us the survival skills and things that we needed.
when you got your first glimpse of the Antarctic, was it everything you'd hoped for?
I'm not sure. The first real glimpse I had was at a place called Deception Island, which is a volcanic crater, and it's a bit like a coal tip, you know, everything's black, so, and it was covered in cloud most of the time, and we were sitting up in this cloud trying to get some observations. So, but there are, I mean, we then went down the tourist route down through the Lemaire Channel, and I mean, that was just, yes, quite very spectacular, to put it mildly, yes.
Yeah. So what had they told you would be doing when you got down there? What was your job brief, Frank?
The plan was that we'd land to build a new base hut for the six-man team on a place called Adelaide Island, which hadn't been visited before, really. People had touched on the fringes of it, but the centre of the island was nobody had been to. And our brief then was to put in ground control for mapping from aerial photographs. So we were to provide fixed points on the ground, identify them on the photographs, and then the mapping would be compiled from the aerial photography, which we already had.
That was the plan.
Unfortunately, we didn't get in. The sea ice was too bad, and we didn't get in there that first year. So we were taken back and put in an old hut that hadn't been used for, I don't know, 10 years or so, in a place called Argentine Islands, where there was a big existing scientific base, British base, about half a mile away. So we spent the first winter there. The plan then was to fly us in from the Argentine Islands with the two aircraft that the survey had at that time. Unfortunately, when the aircraft came down in the early spring to the Argentine Islands, one of them landed and went through the sea ice and was a total loss. So that was the end of that plan. And I was lucky enough to get out on a summer survey, working with Chris Brading and some of the other people around Hope Bay. And then the following year, we did get into Adelaide Island, and we built the base, and we started on the survey.
We'll come back to that in a moment, but I'm just interested about Wordy House that you spent this time in. What was it like when you got there?
Well, it had an interesting history, because originally Alfred Stevenson and the British Graham Expedition had been their base, and they'd built a hut there. And this hut mysteriously disappeared in the early 1950s, I think. It just went. There were quite big ice cliffs nearby, and one theory was that the ice cliff had collapsed and washed it away, but that seemed a bit unlikely. The more likely explanation was that the Argentinians came and dismantled it and took it away for political reasons. So the new hut was actually built of timber from Deception Island, from the old whalers' buildings. So it really was a sort of I don't know what you'd call it. Yes, probably a good word. A sort of traditional Antarctic wooden-built base hut made out of sort of odd bits of timber, you know.
What was it like to live in? Because it hadn't been used for a long time, had it?
No, we made it quite comfortable. We had all the stores that were landed for the hut that we were supposed to be going to build. So we had a Rayburn cooker, and which we fitted, and of course the bunks and things were already there. It was very comfortable. It was bigger than the hut we were supposed to be going to be living in, and we made it very comfortable. I think we had a very good year there. Unfortunately for me, the base leader at Argentine Islands at the scientific base was a man called Bill Murray, who was also a surveyor, and part of his job was doing a large scale survey. Mapping survey of the Argentine Islands to produce a large-scale map, and we were able to help him with that. So he actually had three surveyors working on the job instead of just one.
So you weren't frustrated by the fact you couldn't get to do Plan A?
It was a bit frustrating, but you know, we accepted it. What could you do? And we had this plan that we were going to be flown in, which was quite exciting. And then of course that unfortunately failed. And then I say I was lucky enough. I asked if I could come out and join on this summer survey, and one of the ships sort of came down to the edge of the ice specially for me, and I had another man came with me, and we got out that way. So, you know, I had a reasonably productive summer.
And that was worthwhile work, but it wasn't a case of finding jobs for the boys.
Oh, no, no.
It was worthwhile material.
No, the Joinville survey was an important thing. And then, in fact, we did have in some ways it was a holiday, but... Because Christmas was coming up, and work on the survey, I think, was suspended. I can't quite remember. Anyway, I was able to stay on the ship, which then did a trip up to South Georgia and across to the South Sandwich Islands and eventually back down to Hope Bay again. And the reason we were allowed to make this trip was the ship was towing a magnetometer behind it on about 300 metres of cable, doing a continuous record of magnetic field. And to go with that, they needed a continuous echo sounder trace from the ship. So we were put on the ship's echo sounder and we were doing watches of 4 hours on and eight off to keep a continuous trace, marking it every quarter of an hour. And so we were doing something productive.
What was the echo sounder technology like in those days?
It worked very effectively. We actually went over the South Sandwich Trench, which is, I think, is about 4,000 fathoms deep or something. And I can remember that clearly because we went over the edge of it. And I think the echo sounder was only calibrated up to about 1,000 fathoms or something. But you could keep... It was one of these where you had to turn the knob and you could keep moving it round and then writing on in wax pencil what the real depth was. And this trace just went down and down and down until it bottomed out at about 4, and we got it all the way down, so we felt very pleased with ourselves.
Surprise, really,
yes, yes, no, it did.
Worked so well.
Yeah, no, it was great.
Okay. Let's just go back a little. Well, we're leaping about a bit, but that's okay.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in this Joinville survey, which is a new word to me, Joinville. Yeah. So can you elaborate on what that was?
Well, Joinville is just the name of one of the major islands in the group off the northern end of the Antarctic Peninsula where Hope Bay is. So it was basically a survey being run by the Hope Bay surveyors, Chris Brading and Dick Harbour. And the name comes from one of the early French explorers, Charcot. So hence there are quite a lot of French names, Lemaire Channel. They all go back to Charcot's expedition in the early 1900s. And it was... I'm trying to remember whether we had assistance from the Navy and the helicopters on it. Perhaps we didn't. Perhaps it was all done by boat. I can't remember. I'm not sure now. But the sea ice at the northern end of the peninsula isn't stable enough to travel on, so the only way of getting to these islands was by boat in the summer. So it was a summer survey to extend the mapping control out from the northern end of the mainland, so to speak.
That was a summer survey you were talking about a few minutes ago.
Yes, yeah. So it was just called the Joinville survey because that was a major island in the group.
Was it tough work or a piece of cake?
It was... Well, some of the boat landings were tricky, you know, and... Well, that you had to get all the kit... We were using the ship's sort of surf boats, and... So you had to unload the gear from the boat onto rocks or whatever, and survey equipment is, some of it's quite sensitive and doesn't like being dropped or getting wet for that matter. Yeah, so you had to be careful, but it wasn't too arduous, no.
Well, you've done surveying work a lot of your life. What's so fascinating about it?
For me, the travel, going to new places, you know, often places with mapping work, often they're places which there aren't any maps, so they're relatively remote and perhaps not so many people have been there, you know. And I enjoy the challenge of the work as well, getting to places, you know, the physical challenge of getting there.
So it's what goes with the work that was fascinating for you rather than the work itself?
Yes, but the work itself is... I mean, I was only a small part of the whole process, obviously. I say we're providing like a skeleton of fixed points, and then a lot of the actual mapping work, the compilation of the maps, would be done back in... probably in Britain, in an office somewhere, you know, by other people. So we were just one link in the chain.
Again, looking back, how accurate would you say you were able to be?
In the Antarctic? Mm. Well, the conditions were against us. The photography that we were using was far from ideal. It was very... I mean, now, of course, a lot of the mapping is now produced from satellite imagery, which doesn't have the quality of aerial photography, but in some ways is more suitable for mapping. And the other thing, I think, was our own probably lack of experience. We were all straight out of university, and we didn't have... I mean, I had no previous survey experience to speak of at all. So in a lot of ways, we were learning, and we probably made mistakes. You know, we did make mistakes, I'm sure. I mean, in some ways, the survey might have been better to employ more experienced people, you know, but... the policy at that time was to recruit people straight out of university, and we got the job done. I think the accuracy was adequate for the sort of work we were doing, you know, and the scale of mapping that was going to be produced, I'm sure.
So some of those errors did creep onto the paper, onto the maps, then, you reckon, to be corrected later?
Possibly.
Do you know why they were so keen on new recruits? Did you work out why it was that they were taking new boys?
Probably people hadn't married, they didn't have family responsibilities, you know, they were eager for sort of experience and to travel, I suppose, yeah. Mm. And possibly this business that we are getting on well as a small group. Possibly younger people are a bit more flexible, I don't know.
What kind of technology were you using for doing this surveying work? The latest technology, or...?
That was part of the problem we had on my second year, that we didn't have the latest technology. It had been used in the Antarctic, and we'd been using it, but at that stage the survey didn't have enough equipment to provide us with what we needed. And in fact, my second year, when we actually got onto Adelaide Island, certainly my part of it was, to some extent, was a bit frustrated and wasted, because we were trying to do survey with methods which really didn't fit the terrain we were having to work in. And had we had newer technology, I'm thinking of things like, by this stage in the late 50s, electromagnetic distance measurement equipment, it was a system called telerometer, had been developed. And this was basically two receivers which sent a signal to the other one, sent it back, and it told you the distance in between the two. And this would measure up to 100 miles. I mean, it was line of sight. If you could see it, you could measure it, you know. And that was just coming in, and had been used for a couple of years previously in the Antarctic. And in fact, the following year after I left, they did get that equipment, and it sort of, things progressed a little more quickly.
Did he ever hear why it was you couldn't have it?
I think it was partly cost. May have been difficulty getting the equipment itself. There weren't a lot available at that time. You know, there wasn't a huge production of them. It was very new machines.
They were being made in South Africa, I think.
That's right, yes. Yeah, they were, yes, yeah. So a man called Waddley invented them. But,
again, this is perhaps something you wouldn't have thought about at the time, but looking back on it now, were you mapping just for the sake of mapping, or was there a grander plan in the British government's mind?
Well, we always assumed that there was this plan of the political background and the contested claims with Argentina and Chile.
Can you elaborate?
Well, there'd been quite a few incidents that we knew of. I mean, I don't think we always found that the Argentinians and the Chileans on the ground very friendly on a personal basis, but there had been incidents, which had been reported in the press and everything. So obviously we were aware of the political situation, and the base leader was a magistrate. I mean, had a formal document to say that he was a magistrate, and he had a post office, and this constituted an administration which supported a political claim, and mapping the area obviously was important too, from the point of view of supporting claims to ownership of the territory.
If you want to claim a piece of land, first you must map it.
Well, not necessarily, but you have to administer it. And mapping is an important part of administration, so that you can show where it is that you're claiming and how much of it, and so on.
And that's something you came to that conclusion at the time to do.
Oh yes, I think we were all aware of the situation. Yes.
You had a couple of interesting adventures, I would say. One was that you were on the Kista Dam when it got
That's right.
Yes. Can you tell me the story, Frank?
This was my first sort of summer down there, and as I said earlier, we were trying to get into Adelaide Island to establish this place.
So this is base.
Early 1960, yes. 1960. Yeah, 59-60 summer down, southern summer. They weren't new techniques, but we had a float plane on the ship. The idea was that... I think they'd already had reports that it was not a good ice year, and Sir Vivian Fuchs was on the ship. He'd come down to sort of take charge, I think, and so we had a float plane on the ship. The idea was that the problem on a ship is that you've only got about a 10-mile radius from the crow's nest that you can see. So of course, with a float plane, you can get up much higher and get a much bigger picture of the extent of the ice and what have you. But even with that sort of thing, we eventually got stuck quite close to Adelaide Island, not very far off, and the ship just didn't have the power to move through the ice, and we really were sort of icebound. I don't know what would have happened, but fortunately, there was an Argentinian icebreaker which was also having trouble, although she was an icebreaker and we were a sort of Danish cargo ship. And the Americans came down to assist her, and then they came on and actually got us out.
So this is the glacier.
The glacier, yes, yeah. I mean, to give you an idea, I think our ship was about 1,700 horsepower, and the glacier is something like 44,000 horsepower. You know, sort of quite a. I mean, she was just steaming through ice that was just holding us fast. You know, so she just came up and sort of steamed round us in a circle and just broke us out. And but then we had quite a job following her because her wash was so enormous. If we got too close, the ship just got pushed off to one side by the glacier's wash from her propellers.
But, when you were fast in the ice, beset, I think is the correct phrase, isn't
yes,
it?
That's right, yeah.
What did you do with yourselves?
Well, that was a bit of a problem because there was nothing to do. And in fact, we had a bit of an incident that I don't think Sir Vivian was too pleased with the amount of beer that was being drunk on board. And of course, it was a Danish ship, so there was lots of Carlsberg. And at one stage, he sort of closed the bar and some of us got into a bit of trouble for drinking too late in the night. But this was simply boredom. I mean, there was nothing to do. And at that stage, we weren't sure what was going to happen. So it was a frustrating time, yeah.
Was there an air of concern on the ship that it might end in tragedy?
Oh, no. I mean, the ship actually was an extremely strong vessel. She was built for the Greenland trade. So she was, and of course, she was designed as a round-bottom ship. So as the pressure came on, in fact, we were sort of listing quite a bit at one stage because of the force of the ice, but she was being lifted by the ice. So, no, I don't think we ever felt that we were in the middle of a potential disaster. It was, but presumably we could have been stuck there for the winter if they hadn't come there, if the Americans hadn't come and got us out.
What did you make of Fuchs?
I think he was a rather distant man. As I say, most of the FIDS people were fairly young. There were a sprinkling of older people, but most of us were fairly young. It was very much a sort of, I suppose you might almost call it a democratic society, you know. If there were decisions to be made, people tended to sort of all have their say. Whereas I think Fuchs was much more authoritarian. He was much more used to giving orders and expecting them to be obeyed, and that didn't always go down terribly well with the rank and file. So hence on this, when we were all getting a bit bored and frustrated, I don't think he quite sort of sympathised with our feelings at that stage, you know, and felt we were being a bit unruly and uncouth, I suppose.
Did your generation of FIDS have respect for him?
I think we did for his achievements, yes. One of my major feelings on FIDS always that people were judged very much on their abilities in their job, whatever they were recruited for. And however sort of unpleasant their personal habits might be, if they did their job well, that excused almost anything, you know. It's, because you depended on other people to do their jobs, you know. And if they weren't competent, then everybody had a problem, you know. And but I say I think Fuchs was probably a bit too distant and a bit too remote from the majority, and so none of us ever really got to know him very well, I don't think. Although we were on a ship, with quite a small ship, for a month or more.
Yeah, so. I heard that he would lean to and help unload when you were relieving a base, or he would muck in to do the work with the rest of you. Is that something you remember or not?
I don't remember that because we didn't actually.
Right. Yeah.
No, I don't remember that. I have to say, yeah, I think he was sort of busy with higher things to.
There was another problem at sea, wasn't there, when the Bisco and the Christadan came rather too close to each other?
Yes.
Did you witness that?
Yes, I must have been on the Christadan then, yes. This was when we got back up to the Argentine Islands after the glacier had sort of rescued us. and we were unloading all our stuff to go ashore into the old Wordy hut. But I was still on the ship at that stage, and yes, they somehow got their anchor chains intertwined, I think, and the two ships were just blown together. And of course the float plane was on the Kistedan's deck, and the wings stuck out over the side, so as they came together, one of the wings was torn off.
This was a Beaver, wasn't it?
This was a Beaver float plane, the one that had been used for the ice reconnaissance. And so that was a problem. But again, the organisation was most efficient, and they actually got a wing, I think, flown out to Montevideo. One of the ships went up to Montevideo and collected it, brought it back down to Deception Island, and they had an RAF flight which was operating the aircraft of two pilots and two mechanics, and the flight were able to fit this wing during the winter at Deception Island. They had to make quite a few bits and pieces, I think, but anyway, and that was actually the plane that came down to Deception Island, to Argentine Islands, and then went through the sea ice. So that it was an absolute tragedy, because they spent all winter working on it, and it did this one flight and was a total loss.
You saw the impact, did you? Did you see the impact of the wing being torn off?
No, I didn't. I didn't actually view it. No, no, no. I was just on the ship at the time. So
what was the feeling on the ship when that had happened?
A bit depressed. Yes, yeah. And sorry for the RAF people, because it was obviously a lot of work for them in prospect, and very frustrating for them. Yes.
And when the plane went through the ice, that must have been even worse.
yes, that was because obviously it was the end of our sort of proposed spring survey, and yes, it was.
Was the language used? How did that frustration express itself in your colleagues?
I don't know. Not a lot was said. I remember the two mechanics got through quite a lot of whiskey that night. They were obviously more than a bit upset, and I think we obviously all sympathised with them. No, it's hard to say. I'm sorry.
No, it's a long time ago. Don't worry about that. What would you say is the difference? I mean, when was the last time we went south, Frank?
I had another summer survey in, I think it was 1966-67, which not so long after, because I came back in 62, and then three of us were, I was actually seconded from overseas surveys, and three of us, myself, Dick Harbour, who you've met here, and another guy called Howard Chapman, who's in New Zealand now, we all, and funnily enough, we were the three who'd all been together being taught by Norman Leppard, so we had a reunion and went down for, again, a summer survey, working off a naval warship, which was, at that time was Protector, using her helicopters, and so that was the last time I'd been down. Yes,
how would you say that the job you were doing in the Antarctic 50 years ago differs now from the work that's being done today? How does the experience differ?
Well, obviously, the whole range of technology has moved on. I'd say the telerometer system of distance measurement was the initial sort of electronic, digital. That was the beginning of the revolution, which has now gone right through to GPS. So, obviously, the whole technology has changed. The whole speed of work has changed. You know, with GPS, you can work 24 hours a day. I mean, if you're physically capable, you don't have to stop. I mean, we were using dogs. We had 40 dogs on a 6-man base. So the whole sort of ethos, I think, has changed. I suppose we were the end of the historic phase, as you might call it. You
know, the heroic era.
The heroic era, yes, yeah, sort of. People must be more driven now. I mean, driven by the technology as much as anything, you know. And, I mean, I've had no experience of what it's like working down there now. I can only imagine, and clips and things I've seen on television. But the feeling I get is it's probably not such an enjoyable experience now as it was when we were down there. And of course, people, apart from the sort of the base maintenance people, people tend to go down for much more, much shorter periods too. See, we had a month's journey out from Southampton by sea, which probably not a lot of people do now. It's and that was, although I'm not sure I was with anybody who I ended up on base with. But we, I mean, I went out on the Bisco and there must have been 30 of us at least. I can't remember now. 30 or 40, that sort of level. And with a sprinkling of older people who were coming down for a second or third time. So, you know, that month was a chance to find your feet in a way and sort of talk to other people and just sort of mix in, you know.
In your day, how seriously did you take health and safety?
It wasn't an issue. I mean, we're obviously aware there were basic rules that we followed. I mean, we didn't go into crevassed areas with only two men. We would always go in with three men, you know, on the argument that it takes two men to get a one man out of a hole. So there were a few basic rules like that, but that probably was it, just a few basic rules. You know, we were all expected to be reasonably competent in using skis and things like this, that we could sort of at least get around and turn and this sort of thing. And,
any safety issues arise whilst you were base leader that you had to deal with?
Not really, no. I don't think there were, no, so...
I got the impression from the notes here that you felt being a base leader was a fairly straightforward and simple job.
Well, I say, it was only a six-man base, so obviously on a larger base there may be other problems. And everybody's down there, I think everybody among the six of us was committed to what they were doing, so you didn't have discipline problems, you didn't have... I mean, people might occasionally, I don't know what the word is, because we'd read Charcot's book, so we often called it Le Cafard Polaire, you know. People might go very quiet for a day or two. Well, you'd just leave them, you know. And they'd sort of come round and come out of it again, you know.
That. Are we talking about sort of depression here? Or?
Well, I suppose in a way, yes, yeah. But, you know, it was no good trying to jolly them out of it. People would just go through it and come out again. That was fine. So, but, I mean, you didn't have to get people out of bed in the morning or things like this, you know. I mean, people got up because there was work to do, you know. And so we were all committed. So from the discipline point of view, I don't think there were any problems. The main burden was just the administrative one of reports, and the bulk of that was at the end of the year, because the reports that went out by radio were necessarily quite brief, and because we weren't in communication with Port Stanley, we had to go to one of the bigger bases, and then our reports were sent out from there. So nobody wanted a great long reams of paper to transmit, you know, by Morse code. So
the fact that you were almost incommunicado, was that a good thing or a bad thing?
It didn't worry us. I think it's probably something you didn't worry about. You know, we were all fit and healthy, and I say most of us were fairly young. So you know, health was something you didn't worry about really. The dentist had given us a good sort of going over before we got down there, and the feeling was, I mean, the bigger bases obviously had doctors, but all they ever seemed to have to deal with was perhaps, you know, an occasional broken bone or something like this if somebody had fallen. But I don't think anybody ever worried about serious health issues.
So you weren't, because of the poor communications, you weren't receiving regular orders from HQ. From London.
No. I mean, we had a programme of work for the year, and that was it. We got on and did it, you know, and then at the end of the year, you would write a report to say what you'd done and how much you'd done, and perhaps why you hadn't succeeded in doing what you were asked to do. But I suppose you could almost call it a string and wire organisation, but it worked, and we achieved what we could achieve, I think.
Did he have wireless? Did he have wireless? Any kind?
How do you mean? The
radios of any kind?
Oh, yes. I say we actually had a radio operator. I mean, all the bases had a radio, but the sets we had weren't big enough to communicate reliably with Port Stanley. This was on our six-man base, so we spoke to another base which was about 100 miles away. So everything was routed through that, through the radio operator there. And then, of course, the field parties all had small, they were actually ex-army sort of walkie-talkie type sets. So they would be in voice communication because they wouldn't be so far away.
Reliable?
Yes, 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 it all worked. It was all valve technology, of course, no.
Valves in freezing conditions, anyway.
Yes, but it all worked, yeah, yeah, that was good.
But what about the sense of impact on the environment? I mean, did you consider the environment? You talked about killing seals, presumably to feed dogs.
Yes.
Did you worry about what you were doing to the environment with a big E?
No, because, again, I don't think any of us were very conscious of it. This is all 50 years ago. I mean, I think we were aware that it was a pristine environment, but I think we felt our impact on it was fairly minimal. Even the seals, I mean, we had 40 dogs, and to get them through the winter, we needed about 120 seal. But the ship would often collect these for us, so they'd be taken over quite a wide area. So the feeling was that the impact on the seal population was fairly small, you know.
I mean, so a decision had been made to cull seals across a wide area to protect the colonies?
No. The ship was simply the most convenient way of collecting them, I think, to be honest.
Right, yeah.
I say, people really weren't aware of this sort of thing, you know. It's,
what about your gash, your rubbish?
That went out on the sea ice, yeah. Yeah, and in the spring it disappeared. You know, we knew not where, so... Yeah, so again, the feeling was that there was no, you know, there wasn't an alternative, and nobody was really conscious at that time of the impact that it might have on the environment. Again, with six of us, I suppose there wasn't a huge amount, you know.
And the dogs, did you enjoy the dog work?
Oh yes, they were very. I think they fulfilled, you know, quite a need for companionship and this sort of thing. I mean, obviously you had the other five guys, but, I was fortunate enough the, my second year to have my own dog team.
What were they called?
I had a team called the Counties, which actually came originally from Hope Bay. So it was an old, experienced team, so I didn't have too much trouble having to train them. You obviously got very fond of them because they were all individuals. Their records were kept of all the breeding and this sort of thing. So you knew who their parents were and their grandparents were and so on. And they were individuals and part of the team, you know.
You had an incident at Adelaide Island with one of the dog teams, I believe.
Yes, that probably was my scariest moment down there. We'd broken one or two of the safety rules because we set off with two of us, with two fully loaded sledges. The idea was to travel about 50, 60 miles up onto the centre of the island and leave a depot of food for working in the spring. So the sledges, we were trying to carry as much as we could on the sledges. So one of the mistakes we made was we left skis behind. We didn't take skis because we didn't think we'd need them. It was a sort of straightforward run and there were no crevasses or anything on the way. But it was quite a long, steep climb up from the base to get up onto the sort of more level ice shelf. The other team was quite a young team, and there was quite a nasty sort of wind blowing. We were going straight into it, and eventually the dogs got fed up with this and decided they'd had enough, and they actually turned round and just went back off downhill with the wind behind them. And the driver couldn't, because the sledge was heavily loaded, he couldn't control it, he couldn't turn it over, and he just sort of disappeared down the hill somewhere. So I was left wondering what to do. So I decided, well, I had an older, more steady team that I thought I could control, and if need be, if, you know, I could turn my team to get them to turn back into the slope if I needed to stop. So I decided the only thing I could do was follow him to see what had happened to him. So I set off very gingerly down the slope, and of course eventually I lost control of my team and sledge too, and eventually I found the other chap. It was a guy called Gordon McCallum. Gordon was sort of in a crevasse, sort of up to his waist sort of thing, with his arms out, and I went by saying, hang on, I'll be back, you know, and I couldn't, I was trying to turn the sledge over or get the team to turn around. nothing, and we were just sort of going faster and faster down this slope. And eventually, the sledge did go over. The sledge actually capsized because I'd hit a crevasse, I think, and the back of the sledge went into it. But luckily, the sledge or me didn't go down the crevasse. And of course, we all stopped. And one of my dogs came loose, came out of his harness, and he started running around in circles and suddenly disappeared. And I thought he'd gone into a crevasse. So the only thing I had was a long aluminium pole, you know, which we carried on the sledge. So I then went back up. I thought, well, if I follow my sledge tracks, I'll see if there's any holes, and sort of prodding with the pole. And eventually I got up, and Gordon managed to wriggle out of this hole. Fortunately, he'd wriggled out instead of going down it. And then we had to actually dump. A lot of it was dog food that we were carrying, so we actually had to sort of just dump that and get the sledges organised again. Then I went back to look for this dog that had disappeared. So again, I was going with no sledge tracks this time, going forward, plodding very gingerly, and suddenly I was prodding in space, you know, and I realised I was standing right on the edge of the ice cliff on a big snow cornice, you know, and the dog had gone over the cliff. It's about a 100-foot drop, you know. So I sort of leapt upwards and backwards in one leap. And I think Gordon must have had a rope on me, I think. I think we'd obviously had a rope. And so that was it. We sort of sorted ourselves out and went back to base. You know, we weren't that far away from the base because we were climbing up away from it. And the dog that disappeared reappeared the next day. I think luckily it had landed on a big pile of soft snow at the bottom of the cliff and had enough sense to find his way home. So we survived the incident just with the loss of some dog food, but it was a nasty, because we broke some of the safety rules, basically.
I was going to say, the story started with the words, we didn't think we'd need them, so we left them behind.
Yes, yeah,
In these interviews, quite a few of the incidents that lead to near catastrophe seem to start with a phrase very similar to that.
Yes, yeah. We thought we'd get away with it, you take a chance, and we nearly didn't get away with it. We were very fortunate.
What was your attitude towards chances in the future after that?
I think we were all a bit more careful and, not so willing to take chances then, yeah.
Yeah. So. Interesting stuff, so what would you regard to be the greatest achievement of your time in the Antarctic then? Was it the Joinville survey or...?
It's hard to put a finger on anything, really, I think. I find that quite difficult. Because I say even the year at Adelaide as base leader, it was very much a sort of cooperative effort between the six of us, you know, and I don't think my efforts particularly stood out or... but that's the... Probably the part I feel most gratified about, I think, yes, yeah.
Being a base leader.
Yes, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, I say, from a personal point of view, the survey work I was on that second year was a bit of a disaster because what we were trying to do wasn't really possible. But, so it's probably comes down to I think we had a successful year on the base. It went well.
And, one little detail, which I haven't asked anybody else, these photographs that were taken... aerial photographs. Did you actually have the prints?
Oh yes, yes.
When you went out to do the groundwork?
Yes. It's a bit technical, but a couple of problems. Some of the photography was flown by an American expedition. There was a guy called Finn Ronnie, if you may have heard of. He's quite famous because he had the two ladies who were the first ladies to winter in
Darlington.
Yes, and his own wife, yeah. And he had... I can't remember what sort of aircraft it was now. But they flew a lot of photography. But a lot of it was oblique photography, you know, where the camera isn't vertical, it points obliquely towards the ground, which isn't very good for mapping. There are all sorts of problems. And also a lot of the flight lines were just sort of quite random, you know, where the pilot happened to feel like flying and the camera was switched on sort of thing. The other photography that we worked on, which we didn't actually have any in Adelaide Island... was flown by a British firm called Huntings. They were quite a well-known survey firm. They did ground survey and aerial photography. But they operated from Deception Island, this flooded volcano, which is a very good harbour. And they were using an amphibious aircraft, which unfortunately could only get up to about 20,000 feet, I think, or no, it wasn't as much, about 11,000 feet, I think. And of course, the peninsula, the plateau, goes up to 5,000 feet, so you get all sorts of scale problems. I mean, normally aerial photography for that sort of mapping would be flown at something over 20,000 feet, you know, but they just didn't have an aircraft sort of suitable that they could operate in the Antarctic. So there were a lot of problems with the actual aerial photography. So hence the satellite imagery now really has filled the bill.
But if you had these prints, I mean, the prints would overlap each other quite significantly.
Yes,
and
yeah.
Also, there would be lots of them. So how did you use the prints when you were in the field doing your survey work?
Well, you there wouldn't be that many, you know. They were 9 by 9 inch square prints. Yeah, you just have to carry the full set because you need the overlap to get a stereoscopic image, you know, with a little hand stereo. Yeah, so it's part of the surveyor's gear.
So you're spreading out these photographs in your tent?
Well, you know which pair you wanted. You just they're all serial numbered, obviously. You just flick through until you've got the two or three of the area you want. Yeah, we might have to spread them out in the base hut. That might be more of a problem to spread them all out there. But no, you're just used to using them in the field, you know.
And let's face it, most of the photographs would be white, wouldn't they? So
yes.
How difficult was it to pick out landmarks?
Well, if you've just got snow, it's very difficult, yes. Unless there are sort of, you know, shadows on the snow from something or crevasses or... But then, no, we'd try and put the survey marks on. One of the objects of doing a survey like this is to leave permanent marks behind so that the next guy who comes along has got something to work from. So we'd obviously try and put those on outcrops of rock, which would be stable. I mean, if you have to put stations on snow, then really they're only temporary because they'll move anyway as the ice moves. So
you were building cairns, were you?
Yes, you'd normally try and build rock cairns. I mean, this was a part of the problem I had, I'd say, the second year, that we were working up the side of a sort of mountain chain and we were trying to create triangles. And this is the old days of triangulation to progress up. So, of course, some of the stations had to be out on the ice and it really wasn't feasible or practical. You need to get yourself onto a solid foundation if you can.
You made at least one flight yourself, didn't you?
Sorry,
You made one flight yourself. You flew in a Beaver.
Yeah, I think I said to Amanda, the point I was making was how really sort of green and inexperienced we were, you know. I mean, when I went down there, I'd never flown ever. I'd been to Denmark, but we went on the train, you know. So the first flight I ever had was actually on the Falkland Islands aerial service in the Falklands. We were doing some work there because the mapping of the Falklands was being done at that time by overseas surveys. So it was arranged that they would give us some experience in the Falklands. And so my first flight was on one of the float planes from Port Stanley Harbour, yeah.
How was it?
Oh, exciting, yeah. See all the water going up. Yes,
you've travelled a great deal to some quite strange places, so how does the Antarctic rate in your life now, looking back over your lifetime?
It's still in some ways, it was part of a growing up experience, as I said earlier, that, you know, so it's still very important to me, hence I'm here this weekend, and the people I'm with are still, we still keep in contact with quite a lot of people I was with. I haven't been back. I look at the adverts for the Antarctic cruises now, because I've talked to other people here who have done the cruises. I have the feeling I probably wouldn't like to go back on a cruise because of all the environmental restrictions and what have you that are now in force. You know, when we were down there, it was so free and easy and relaxed. But
did it change you? Did you grow up?
Oh, I think so. Yes, I think I must have done. Yes, yes. When I came back, I think I mentioned earlier, I was fortunate enough to be offered a place at, in overseas surveys, in the UK Civil Service. And that involved a 12-month training course at the School of Military Survey just outside Newbury, as a civilian student, I hasten to add. And I found that quite fascinating because I went there with three other British graduates as part of the course who were straight out of university. And having had a couple of years break, and I probably matured in that 2 years, I got much more out of that year's course than I think the other three guys did, because I was a bit more mature, and also I'd worked. I think when you leave university, you're very cocky and you really think you know it all. And of course, after a couple of years away, I realised how much I didn't know and was much more ready to learn.
Why do you all get together again 4 or 5 decades later?
Something I haven't really thought about. Habit, I suppose. No, it's a chance to catch up with people because, I mean, most of the people here, I perhaps see one or two of them otherwise at other Bass Club organisations and things. But, yes, I think there's an element of nostalgia, without a doubt. I mean, some of us also come for the walking. I mean, I live in the middle of England, so we don't have any mountains there, and it's a chance to get away. But basically, it's to see people, yes, meet people.
You shared a special time together?
I think so, yes. Yes. Yeah. It's yes, there is a bonding, without a doubt. Yeah.
Frank, thank you very much. Thank you.
My pleasure.